Nations and Kings, an article by Brother John Roberts, which appeared in the Testimony special issue, The Wonder of Isaiah, in 2014. In the mercy of God, King Jeroboam II, wicked man though he was, brought some stability to the northern kingdom of Israel. Reigning for 41 years, he fought successfully against the enemies of Israel, and he restored the border of Israel from Lebo Hamath as far as the Sea of the Arabah. For the Lord saw that the affliction of Israel was very bitter, for there was none left, bond or free, and there was none to help Israel. So he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. In the 27th year of this reign, Uzziah became king in Judah. Uzziah, Azariah in the book of Kings, was also a powerful king. And taken together, Israel and Judah were now almost at their largest extent, and their borders were similar to those enjoyed during the later days of David's reign. The area was politically stable, and Judah was feared by its immediate neighbors. God helped him against the Philistines and against the Arabians who lived in Gurbal, and against the Munites. The Ammonites paid tribute to Uzziah, and his fame spread even to the border of Egypt, where he became very strong. Bible quotations are from the ESV, unless otherwise stated. Uzziah strengthened Jerusalem's defences and built fortifications in the wilderness. He also increased the standing army and ensured that it was well equipped by investing heavily in armaments. New sorts of weaponry were designed and developed during his reign. It was during the reign of Uzziah that Isaiah began to prophesy, and he continued his work through the reigns of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. And the peace and power of Uzziah's long reign led to renewed prosperity in Judah. The middle and upper classes became wealthy. Luxury goods were commonplace, and decadence followed. And Isaiah condemned what he saw. The Lord said, "Because the daughters of Zion are haughty and walk with outstretched necks, glancing wantonly with their eyes, mincing as they go along, tinkling with their feet, therefore the Lord will strike with a scab the heads of the daughters of Zion, and the Lord will lay bare their secret parts. In that day the Lord will take away the finery of the anklets, the headbands and the crescents, the pendants, the bracelets and the scarves, the headdresses, the armlets, the sashes, the perfume boxes and the amulets, the signet rings and nose rings, the festal robes, the mantles, the cloaks and the handbags, the mirrors, the linen garments, the turbans and the veils. Instead of perfume, there will be rottenness. Instead of a belt, a rope. And instead of well-set hair, baldness. And instead of a rich robe, a skirt of sackcloth. And branding instead of beauty. In times of real austerity, such trappings as perfumes and fashion accessories are the first to go. But Judah's affluence led to the desire for servants and to the exploitation and oppression of the poor. And here is God's condemnation through his prophet. The Lord will enter into judgment with the elders and princes of his people. It is you who have devoured the vineyard. The spoil of the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people, by grinding the face of the poor? Declares the Lord, God of hosts. Uzziah served God and walked in his ways, and others were encouraged to do the same, but many did not. False worship was still in evidence. The people still sacrificed and made offerings on the high places, and even the traumatic earthquake of these times, see Zechariah 14, of which Isaiah Chapter 2, verse 10, may be a short-term prophecy, seems to have made little difference to either the people's prosperity or their waywardness. No mention is made of it in the historical record. In the end, it was pride that was the undoing of King Uzziah, the result of his attempt to usurp the work of God's high priest, was that he became a leper, living in isolation until his death. And through the prophet, God uses Uzziah's pitiful condition as a symbol of the condition of the whole nation. They too were proud. For the Lord of hosts is a day against all that is proud and lofty, against all that is lifted up, and it shall be brought low. In the eyes of God, they too were sick with a spiritual leprosy. Why will you still be struck down? Why will you continue to rebel? The whole head is sick, and the whole heart faint. From the sole of the foot even to the head, there is no soundness in it, but bruises and sores and raw wounds. They're not pressed out or bound up or softened with oil. And the daughter of Zion is left like a booth in a vineyard, like a lodge in a cucumber field, like a besieged city. Initially, then, the work of Isaiah began against a background which appeared successful from the outside, but which was, on closer examination, far from acceptable to God. Jotham reigned over Judah for 16 years and was a God-fearing man. He did what was right and built the upper gate of the house of the Lord. The genealogical record refers to information relating to the tribes of Reuben and Gad collected in the time of Jotham. It's in 1 Chronicles chapter 5. The 2.5 tribes east of Jordan were often the most vulnerable, and the register compiled in Jotham's day may suggest that this area in Gilead was still strong and prosperous. However, despite Jotham's good example, the nation as a whole was sliding into greater wickedness. The high places for worship of idols still remained, presumably because Jotham did not feel strong or secure enough to remove them. This accounts for the fact that even before Jotham had died, in those days the Lord began to send Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, against Judah. Taking the information from 2 Chronicles 29 and 28, as it appears in the text, that is, disregarding the possibility of overlapping reigns, interregnums, and so on, Hezekiah was 9 years old when his father Ahaz succeeded Jotham. In the years of wickedness that followed, Hezekiah witnessed the folly and sin of his father as he was passing through those impressionable adolescent years. And 2 Chronicles 28 speaks of some of the things he must have seen. Ahaz followed the ways of the kings of Israel and was a worshipper of Baal. He burned his children on the altar fires. And if he was the firstborn son, Hezekiah may have been safe, but how would he feel knowing that his young brothers and sisters were being tortured in this way? Wickedness prospered, with little shrines springing up in every place of prominence and altars beneath every large green tree. And God began to bring trouble on Ahaz. And the city of Jerusalem was besieged by an Israel-Syria alliance, although it was not taken. Elath, the town on Judah's southern border, was lost, and the Jews were driven out. The Syrians killed 120,000 men of Judah in just one day. And these were valiant men, according to the authorized version, some of the best of Ahaz's soldiers. And among those killed were three palace officials close to King Ahaz, who almost certainly would have been known personally to the young Hezekiah. A further 200,000, mostly women and children, were taken away to Israel. They were very probably the widows and orphans of the men killed, and although they later returned to Jericho on asses, they now constituted fractured and destitute families. More warfare and guerrilla raids followed as the Edomites made inroads into the country, resulting in the loss of crops and foodstuffs as the invaders took and lived off whatever cereals and fruit were available. The Philistines captured six cities, together with the surrounding hamlets, and moved into them. And now there was a refugee problem too, and people wandered about the land, seeking shelter or living in caves. Instead of turning to God, Ahaz sought help from Assyria. But the king of Assyria only distressed him further, and Ahaz was obliged to raid the national treasury, bringing the country to its knees financially. No wonder the chronicler writes, "For the Lord humbled Judah because of Ahaz, king of Israel, for he had made Judah act sinfully and had been very unfaithful to the Lord." The temple, already the subject of abuse and idol worship, was closed and quickly fell into disrepair. Any faithful priests and worshippers had long since fled. These were very different times from those of Uzziah and Jotham. They were days of desperate wickedness in which Isaiah prophesied against the king and those who followed paganism. See, for example, Isaiah chapter 3. And large parts of the nation wallowed in wretched poverty and misery. The conditions described above make King Hezekiah all the more remarkable in his desire to do right. Perhaps in part he was influenced by his mother and a few righteous men gathered around him. Perhaps also it was the devastating effects of his father's folly that persuaded him to serve God. "Curds and honey he shall eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good." Curds, or as the AV has, butter and honey, are not luxury goods, as some might imagine, but food produced on land no longer being cultivated. Hezekiah had been raised on these, the fruits of an impoverished land, so that he knew the wisdom of turning to God. And turn to God he did. He set about trying to put things right. Immediately he came to the throne. In the first year of his reign, in the first month, he opened the doors of the house of the Lord and repaired them. He trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, so that there was none like him among all the kings of Judah after him, nor among those who were before him. These words describe a dramatic change. Almost overnight, the climate in Jerusalem was different. This would not have pleased everyone, of course, nor did it change everyone. In many places, wickedness simply went underground. Slowly, however, Hezekiah would win the hearts of many of the people in Judah and bring them back to God. There is a significant contrast between the later reforms of Josiah and those of Hezekiah. Josiah's work was almost a single-handed campaign. Men feared God because they were commanded to do so, whether or not their worship was heartfelt. Hezekiah exhorted and encouraged first the priests and Levites and then the people. His invitation to keep the Passover extended to those north of the border and was ridiculed in some quarters. After this Passover, however, it was the people themselves who, on returning to their homes, smashed the shrines and idols that were so offensive in God's land. A new confidence was once again changing the social climate in Judah. Such enthusiasm is hard to sustain. The wickedness of Judah was such that it merited the later successful invasion by Assyria when 46 defense cities were lost, and only Jerusalem was spared. Yet, in the purpose and providence of God, whose angels slaughtered the Assyrians outside the city walls, this too brought the esteem of surrounding nations. It made Jerusalem important politically, and it was the springboard for prophecies about her later restoration under Messiah. This is the colourful fabric into which the prophecy of Isaiah is woven. True worship, a blue, hot and cold. Prosperity ebbed and flowed. Loyalties swayed, fortunes swung, kings came and went. But above the shifting sands of men, the voice of God rang clear, and his foundation stood secure.